Accession number 21593, Reel 5.
Leslie Winspear, Reel 5.
Looking back at career and trying to summarise the salient features of the way of life of a young soldier there, I think we have to look at the weather. We arrived in November, and by January, when we're on Nha Chon, the temperatures were down to below minus 20. At the same time, the British Antarctic Survey was crossing Antarctica. I think it was Dr. Fuchs, and he was experiencing minus 20. And we were trying to do a soldiering job in these conditions. We improvised heaters in our bunkers, but the petrol burners, as opposed to diesel, were a hazard which produced numerous casualties of people being burnt. For example, a bunker stove would be an ammunition box with a copper tube sticking in out into it, which dripped petrol, which ignited automatically from a petrol can of 5 gallons on the roof. The control was by a tap which gripped the rubber tube more or less tightly on squeezing the tube so that the drops didn't run too quickly. But if anything went wrong, the stove would blow up and so would the can above it, and you'd have casualties from burning. But with temperatures like that and trying to stand in the weapon pits, even the sandbags were frozen. And if you lifted up the sandbag to take out a grenade in the box that was let into the sandbags holding the prime grenades, then the sandbag would crackle because it was frozen stiff and you couldn't move it without making a noise. And camouflage nets were covered in rime and frozen solid. Everything was noisy and difficult to handle in these conditions. You couldn't touch metal without gloves on. You needed 3-finger mittens to be able to fire your rifle. And you wore a 3-finger woolen mitten inside a white complete mitten, which where you could take your thumb out, and you wore the outer mittens on a strap that joined the two together and which travelled down your sleeve from your shoulder, so you didn't lose them. They were so important to everyday life. And so you had to overcome the cold before you could think about dealing with the Chinese army. And I always carried a rifle because I thought it was safest for me and everybody else. So many people were injured by submachine guns, the Sten in particular, as they jumped out of trucks and threw the working parts back and it started firing on its own. Or as they went down the hill into no man's land and somebody at the back slipped and the butt of his weapon hit the ground and he wounded the two chaps in front with a burst from a spontaneous gun. When I went anywhere, I had a loaded rifle, but never a bullet in the breech. That gave me time to take the safety catch off, cock it, and I used to joke that I'd carry a blackened bayonet in no man's land so that if it took me too long to get a round off, at least I'd got that. But I didn't want to injure a colleague through a negligent discharge, which was all too frequent. And it was mostly as a result of the weather. The summer was hot, temperatures over 100 degrees. When Fahrenheit, when you played football in reserve, you spun up to decide who would wear shirts and who wouldn't. You were better off without shirts, it was too damned hot to wear anything. And in between you had the monsoons, violent rainstorms, torrential downpours, roads impassable. This was the background in which you were trying to fight a war efficiently against a badly equipped but enormous Chinese army, which was about 1 million strong, as against about 200,000 United Nations troops.
What opinion did you form of the enemy?
The Chinese were incredibly brave, and the leadership of their officers and political commissars must have been very effective, because when they put in an attack, for example, the first troops would be quite well armed. The second wave would be less well armed. And for example, number one would have a Tommy gun, number two would have a rifle, number three would have two or three grenades, and number four would have a club, because there weren't enough weapons to go around. And number four was told that he would pick up a weapon from a fallen comrade as and when he could. And he, nine times out of ten, before he got onto the objective, he would have a weapon, because the casualties were so heavy. They were very tidy in the sense that in the night attacks, before dawn, they would clear the bodies off the wire and sweep the area clean so that their counted dead couldn't be assessed. But their casualties were enormous. For example, in the Hook battle, it was known from the Chinese intercepts, which were providing better information than we were getting from our forward companies ourselves, because our radios were not functioning well, that they committed three brigades onto a battalion position, and that those three brigades, which would each be about 3,000 or 4,000 strong, making 12,000 committed troops, they all took casualties, and they would lose a third of their strength, either dead or wounded, at least. But we could never be certain, because the battlefield was always swept clear afterwards.
Did the political aspect of the war mean anything to you at the time?
It did, but I didn't talk about it amongst my fellow soldiers. As far as the average soldier in the Duke of Wellington's was concerned, he didn't know I'd been to grammar school. I told him I'd been a builder's labourer, which was true because my father was a builder. And I kept my education and my political beliefs to myself. But
why did you want to keep your grammar school education a secret?
I think because of my innate sense of egalitarianism, I wanted to be one of the boys. I decided if I wasn't going to go up the ladder, then I'd be one of the boys, and that would do. Again, I think back to my mining village background, where the community was all. But there was a bit more to it than that, and it went back to the post-war elections, I think, and also to the fact that there was a miner from the next village, Margrave Park, who went out to Spain and joined the International Brigade. And I'd already started taking an interest in political matters, and I was very much in favour of the democratic principle, and communism was certainly totalitarian and had to be resisted, as far as I was concerned. And that was a factor, in which I didn't make much of at the time, in my volunteering for the Korean War. It's probably a factor as well in that I've always said ever since that the only political party I could work for was the Labour Party, because it was the only one that took any interest in the less well-endowed members of society. And all these things were threads in my thinking at the time. I went on to read my part-time study while I was working in the civil service, an economics degree, and my special study area was constitutional law. I could almost outline for you the constitution of practically every country in the world as a result of that, because I was interested in making comparisons of how political systems worked. For the same reason, I could never have worked in private industry for the profit motive. And I wanted to work in the public interest, and that probably goes back to Korea.
What did you think of your allies in Korea?
The best soldiers were the Australians. The Australian soldier is hard and tough. The best officers are trained under the British aegis. They make wonderful soldiers. The next best, as far as I could see, were the Turks. I used to deliver patrol reports to the Turks every day when we were on the hook. That was part of my job. We used to tell each other where our patrols were going the next night so we wouldn't shoot each other up. And when they got used to me, I'd be flagged down, for example, and they'd say, come and look at this, and they'd have a dead Chinese. They'd say, we got him last night. We went out into his lines. And in one battle with the Americans, when they were supporting the Americans, for example, the Turks were attacked in these low hills that seemed easy to break through in wave attacks by the Chinese. And the Turks fought them off with their American Browning machine guns until they reached the bottom of the slope of their little hill. And then they abandoned their machine guns, grabbed their rifles and long bayonets, and stood on the parapet of the trench waiting for them. And they fought them off with the bayonet. And then they chased what was left of them back across no man's land until they were recovered. They were fanatical in the Janissary tradition, in the extreme. The Indian Army medical units were very good. I couldn't say much to fault the Commonwealth Division, except there was a certain amount of laxity amongst the Canadian troops, who would be found in no man's land the night after they'd been sent out with their throats cut, because they'd gone to sleep while on patrol and the Chinese had crept up on them and killed them in their sleep. The Americans Everybody knows the bug out tradition in Korea. And it seemed strange that after the war, they should still be working on an attack philosophy with no training at all, and certainly little psychological training in the art of defense and the need to defend to the last man and the last round.
Any contact with Korean civilians?
A little. When I went to the leave camp at Ebisu, we were able to move about freely through the villages, and many of the villagers spoke enough English to make communication. Ebisu was near Incheon on the port of Seoul on the coast, and the leave center was a stockaded old monastery, but I was able to walk out to the villages which were in sight and talk to people and have a cup of Japanese tea and so on, and I was fascinated by their A-frames on which they carried fodder, hay for their cattle, and they would go up into the hills and cut reeds and green shoots to give to their livestock, and they'd carry huge loads like this, and they had very little wheeled, by way of wheeled vehicles or carts or anything, and they were almost Indian in their, they were very much peasant economy. They didn't seem to want to see anything beyond the level of village life. One of the big problems, of course, there were, I think, 6 million orphans in Korea, and orphan schools used to come and give little concerts to us while we were in reserve and make collections to keep them going, because there were so many orphans to be fed. This was a result of the movement of the war down to the south and then back again, and the disruption of family life and parents being lost and killed and so on.
How do you feel now about having served with the Dukes in Korea?
It was as valuable to me as any other part of my education. I think I was lucky to end up in the Dukes, but it wouldn't have mattered if I'd been with anyone else, I don't think. It was a valuable experience. It gave me a measure for everything else that followed. Why get upset about something if, for example, if at the end of the day you're still safe in life and limb? It gave a wonderful sense of perspective, which has never left me.
Did you have any after effects of having served there, either physical, mental, or what?
I had nightmares for a few years afterwards. For example, when I left the army on the 21st of December, I think it would be 1952, and I started work at the Ordnance Factory in, at Rotherham, near Rotherham, with the Ministry of Supply on the 3rd of January the following year. So I only had Christmas leave. And the need for this, apparently, was to keep my superannuation going, because it had started on the date I joined the army as a national serviceman, having passed the executive class exam. And I eventually found digs in near Rotherham in Maltby with a family where I was eventually asked to leave, because the man of the house was an ex Bevin boy from wartime who'd settled and married, and he often worked nights, and his wife said she was afraid to hear me shouting out in my sleep when he wasn't there. And so I was asked to leave, and I used to have these nightmares occasionally, infrequently, and they gradually diminished over the years.
What specific things were disturbing your mind?
There were a sort of response mechanism that we were under attack or going, and that I had to get into action quickly. Brief but violent.